U.S. economic growth in the red.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM in New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith with the Marketplace Midday Update. The U.S. economy contracted in the first quarter of 2014. That's the first negative growth in 3 years. The Commerce Department announced gross domestic product ticked down 1%. Diane Swank is the chief economist at Mesirow Financial. Diane, why did economic growth contract?
You know, what we saw was, particularly in retail, a lot of people couldn't sell a lot of inventories in the second half of 2013, and they stocked them up on their shelves. They had a lot of discounting, and then we had really bad weather. We saw that all those inventories drained, not because we sold so much, but also because production came down. Production was scheduled to fall as we went into the first quarter because of an overhang in inventories, but also we saw disruptions to production because of unusually harsh winter weather. Things literally couldn't get from one place to the other, and that meant that those inventories could fall off a bit, even though demand was not terrific in the first quarter.
So can we entirely explain this with severe winter weather, or what does growth look like if you take out extenuating circumstances?
You know, the underlying pattern is still really weak, 1.5%, and that's less than half the pace we saw in the second half of 2013. It appears that we've hit another lull in growth, even with the catch-up we're seeing in the second quarter. And what's going to concern the Fed is whether or not we can see stronger growth in the second half, most notably in housing, which has been really lackluster. Sales are still below a year ago right now.
Can we have robust economic growth without a housing market recovery?
The housing market got us into this crisis. It's got to get us out. We can't have robust growth. We can have growth, but not robust growth without a stronger housing market.
Diane Swank is the chief economist at Mesirow Financial. Diane, thank you.
Thank you.
Today, the White House hosts a summit about concussions in youth sports. The subject is a big issue for football, and there's now a rush to bring solutions to the market. But as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports, the technology has yet to catch up with the demand.
Some believe the solution lies in gels or extra padding in football helmets, but the helmet may be of limited value in reducing concussions.
Helmets stop skull fractures, but we think it's the primary rotation movement to the head that produces a concussion.
Professor Dennis Malfies at the University of Nebraska is working with electrodes to diagnose concussions. Other researchers have taken different approaches.
People are very interested in using biomarkers, so saliva, blood samples that can pick up on elements that reflect damage in the brain.
It will still be years before any of them reach the market, but teams want to protect themselves, too. Patrick Risch is a sports economist at Webster University in St. Louis.
There's no question that you could see more lawsuits pertaining to concussions at all levels of football.
Brain injuries associated with football can impair a person's ability to earn a living, and therapy can run into the millions. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
So, yeah, we know it. Public radio can be sort of spinachy sometimes. You listen because you want to learn something. It's educational. Turns out that was the plan from the start. As part of our series Learning Curve on the intersection of education and technology, Marketplace's Adrian Hill gives us the history of educational radio.
Public radio got its start in the classroom.
Broadcasting began in the United States largely on university campuses. I mean, in engineering departments where people were experimenting with radio and building radio sets.
Michelle Helms is a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. By the mid-1920s, those engineering experiments were becoming stations, broadcasting educational programs, first for homemakers and farmers.
And later got into schoolroom broadcasts where kids in schools could actually listen to things that related to their, you know, their lessons.
Dozens of state universities, departments of education, and school boards created shows for kids.
Today, Mr. F. Leslie Speer, supervisor of social studies, we'll take you behind the headlines.
That's from WBOE in Cleveland, where the BOE stood for Board of Ed. The board even had specially made school radios that picked up only its station. WHA, now a part of Wisconsin Public Radio, had one of the most active schools of the air. There were music classes, drama, and nature shows like A Field with Ranger Mac.
Hello, boys and girls. We're standing at the threshold of another year.
The idea was simple. Students could learn from great teachers everywhere, broadcasting would transform education so long as there was a radio in the classroom. But the revolution never came. A lot of schools didn't have radios, and a lot of the shows just weren't that good.
If you talk to people, old practitioners in public broadcasting, they actually use educational radio as a pejorative.
Josh Shepard is a professor at Catholic University in Washington, D.C.
In truth, the best and most effective educational broadcasts did come out of the networks.
CBS had the American School of the Air, NBC the Music Appreciation Hour. But, says Shepard, commercial radio was designed to make money, and there just wasn't much in broadcasting to school kids. Gradually, the public stations that stayed on the air started making better radio, less geared to students sitting, listening in circles, and more for learners like us. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
You can see if your public radio station has roots in education. Check out our map at marketplace.org/learningcurve. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith, and this is the Marketplace Midday Update. This is APM, American Public Media.